against the Israeli regime and called for an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have soared in Al-Quds in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against committing violations in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be tolerated by the Palestinian people. Our people will defend Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque with all means. Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that must not be crossed.
People have come out to reiterate their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against the Israeli attacks. Al-Quds is a holy region of significant importance for all Muslims around the world.
Palestinian resistance groups will defend Al-Quds and will always be a safety valve to protect our people. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
This protest is sending a strong message to the whole world that Gaza will not sit idly while Al-Quds is being desecrated. Al-Quds is the eternal capital of Palestine. We also want to condemn the daily killing of our people in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces and the construction of illegal settlements as well as home demolitions.
Since the Israeli occupation of Al-Quds in 1967, the city and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinians in the blockaded coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well-wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes and flags flying at half-mast symbolised the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the King instead of God save the Queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a seven-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically, overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there are questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, Press TV was informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs radicalized by foreign extremism. At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community. Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religious groups, especially Muslims, who've become a prime target of India's Hindu extremist rhetoric. Local activists informed us that they believe it's the same Hindutva hate which has caused the rise in Islamophobia here in Britain.
The Muslims and the Hindus in Leicester have been getting along for decades. We've not had no issues. It's these latest crowds of these young Hindutva ideology thugs, RSS, the BJP thugs. This mentality, they come with this mentality, they're trying to bring it down here, and they're very, very racist, and they're the ones who are causing the problems in the community.
This year, at least three severe attacks have occurred, with at least two victims being hospitalized. The media has so far only focused on a recent outpouring of anger by local Muslims, venting their frustrations via scuffles with the police on Monday night. But if the alleged problem of Hindu radicalism isn't dealt with soon, Muslim vigilantism may become the go-to option for some furious locals. Robert Carter, Leicester.
It's been dubbed the most right-wing cabinet for a generation. Formed after new PM Liz Truss's fulsome support for her predecessor and a purge of defeated rival Rishi Sunak loyalists. Some of the familiar faces, Kwasi Kwarteng, a free marketeer and Truss's ideological soulmate, confirmed as chancellor. Ex-leadership candidate Suela's Braverman, admired by the right-wing for attacks on, quote, woke politics, appointed home secretary. Staunch ally James Cleverly, promoted as foreign minister. On his entree, Ukraine and fixing relations with the EU, strained after Brexit, among other things. Close friend Theresa Coffey will be deputy prime minister and health secretary. The National Health Service is reeling under a staff and cash crisis. And another carryover from the Johnson administration, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the man who blamed the energy crisis in the UK on climate alarmists, will be business and energy secretary.
What we therefore have is a very clearly defined agenda with Liz Truss surrounding herself by people she thinks will be loyal to her and will share some quite central policy objectives, which I'd suggest are sharper than those of her predecessor.
The makeup of the Truss team goes against her pledge to use what she called all the fantastic talents of the Conservative Party.
Liz Truss won less than 60% of the Conservative Party membership vote, and when she threw her hat in the ring for party leadership, she won fewer than a third of the Conservative MPs' votes, which means that she could have done herself a favor by trying to appeal to as wide a base of parliamentary support as possible.
Especially because she will need her party's support for her plans for her three priorities, the economy, energy, and the NHS.
So they might grumble in private, but they'll show the impression of unity in public. The biggest issue, though, for her is that if she does controversial things in legislative terms, which MPs think aren't going to work, then she could have problems.
The 56th UK Prime Minister takes up the reins of power as the UK toils under spiralling levels of inflation, skyrocketing energy costs, an economy almost certainly in recession, and public services on the brink. It remains to be seen if she and her cabinet can deliver on her promises. Saeed Purizat, London.
The Seoul Defense Dialogue Security Forum addressed the North Korea issue Wednesday as leading military strategists grappled for a coherent policy toward Pyongyang. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line involves strengthening the U.S. alliance and bolstering military capabilities, including a potential preemptive strike.
Kill Chain will pre-detect North Korea's nuclear missile launch and be able to interfere with it, blocking any incoming nuclear attacks. And in order to prevent the worst case, we are intensively organizing the defense budget and developing military strategies to prepare a military retaliation.
President Yoon promised to normalize operations of the U.S. anti-ballistic missile system, THAAD, which was deployed in 2017, with new equipment brought in late Sunday night in an attempt to foil local protesters. Yoon has said he would like to deploy more THAAD missile batteries. At the forum, President Yoon's hard line was echoed by Japan.
There could be a lot of sanctions that would be imposed together with other countries, and there could be certain measures which some countries can do unilaterally, and it's a kind of a combination, but we have to share the same goal of urging North Korea to accept the terms. We have to figure out where it hurts most for the North Koreans.
Several forum speakers stressed coordinated sanctions, which have so far failed, yet offered few alternatives. Settling the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and ending sanctions against Pyongyang will require bringing North Korea to the negotiating table. But so far, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, appear unwilling to provide much incentive for North Korea to re-enter talks. Also on Wednesday, the nuclear envoys of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan met in Tokyo to coordinate strategies seeking to denuclearize North Korea. The U.S. repeated its offer to meet unconditionally with North Korea, while U.S.-led unilateral and U.N. Security Council sanctions remain in place. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Italian government has introduced a number of measures aimed at curbing electricity consumption this winter amid soaring gas prices and fears of more disruptions. Italy relies on natural gas for 40% of its electricity production. On Tuesday, Roberto Cingolani, the Minister for the Ecological Transition, announced energy-saving measures ranging from turning down thermostats in apartment blocks and public buildings by 1 degree and shortening the time the heating can be on by 1 hour a day and 15 days across the year.
It could be a solution, but on second thought, I don't know how useful this measure would be. What I do know is that it's always us people who pay the price.
Hospitals, nursing homes, primary and play schools will be exempt from the energy-saving measures. The policy introduced by the Italian government is part of an EU plan which calls on member states to voluntarily reduce their gas demand by 15% compared to their average consumption in the past 5 years between August 1st and March 31st next year. However, the gas demand reduction becomes mandatory if supplies reach crisis levels.
Italy has decided to do without the Russian gas, which amounted to about 40% of its supplies, and opted to embrace a supplier diversification strategy. Also, Germany did the same. Now it takes five members of the bloc to demand the European Council to make the energy saving plan mandatory. For instance, if Russia opts to cut altogether its gas supplies to Europe.
There are concerns on how the implementation of energy-saving measures will be monitored by the government. For now, the Ministry for the Ecological Transition has called on individuals to play their part. It remains to be seen whether this will be enough. Max Civili, Rome.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Drive a little bit slower. I want to see the city better.
Yes, madam. And don't forget to visit Chehel Sutun Palace during your stay in Pazmin.
Sorry, sir, but you're kidding? Chehel Sutun Monument is situated in Isfahan, not in Qazvin.
But we also have Chehel Sutun here in Qazvin. We call it Chehel Sutun Palace.
Oh, I didn't know that. I feel curious to see it. This Chehel Sutun Palace. So, please give me a ride to this monument. One of the most important monuments of Safavid era is Chehel Sutun or Kolah Farangi edifice in Qazvin, located in the middle of a large garden. This building is one of the remaining royal palaces of the Shah Tahmasp era. The building was known as Kolah Farangi when Qazvin was the capital in the Safavid dynasty. This edifice was rebuilt by Muhammad Baqir Sa'd al-Saltaneh, the governor of Qazvin in Qajar period, and it was named Chehel Sutun in that time. Kolah Farangi edifice and Ali Qapu entrance gate are the only remained buildings from the Safavid era in Qazvin that is built in an octagonal building in two floors. The building has halls and small rooms on each floor, made too small in a plaid way and have very elegant and beautiful wooden windows. A porch with brick columns and semi-circular arcs cover the building, and a porch with wooden pillars has been built on top of it. Wall paintings on the first floor are samples of Qazvin Painting School with a global reputation. The walls, which are decorated with paintings, are unique in their kind. Now, at the Calligraphy Museum of Qazvin, this building is a place to keep the precious works such as calligraphies, old books, etc. The Chehel Sutun Palace was registered as a national property in Iran's Cultural Heritage Organization in 1955. Thank you. Well, I am now in the southern part of Azadi Square in Qazvin. Walking on a very nice looking sidewalk, which is adorned elegantly. And here's the entrance of Safavid Garden Complex, which has placed Chehel Sotun inside. Let me walk inside. Wow! A garden full of old, robust trees. Maybe each tree has its own story to tell. And here we have Chehel Sotun Palace of Qazvin, a gorgeous two-story octagonal building. A beautiful porch with brick pillars and semicircular arcs surround the monument, and a porch with wooden pillars is located above it. Well, this building is a remarkable example of the ancient history of Iran. Well, let me enter the first floor. This floor has a big hall with four rooms in four sides of it. The windows of this monument used to be open in the past. This let the fresh air come inside the building. However, today they are closed for the protection of the building. And what is interesting is that there used to be pools in the northern, southern, and central parts of the hall, which actually helped cooling of the air. Today, just the southern and central pools have remained and, of course, repaired. Amazing! Is part and parcel of Iranian culture. These walls, which are decorated with paintings, are unique. The wall paintings of the first floor are indicating the miniature art of the Qazvin school with global reputation. I am now in the second floor. As you may know, Qazvin is known as the capital of calligraphy of Iran due to having variety of prominent calligraphers. Therefore, this mansion was dedicated to Museum of Calligraphy in 2001, and art of calligraphers are on display in this museum. I'm really interested in calligraphy. Enjoy sweet memories in green space of the garden located in the palace. This palace is narrating part of art and history of Iran So don't hesitate and choose this attraction to create brilliant, everlasting moments for you and your companions. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The 9/11 anniversary is upon us yet again. There was a time when the anniversary was a time to reflect on whether U.S.'s so-called war on terror was successful or not, and why Saudi Arabia, where 15 of the 19 hijackers were from, was not held to account. But For as much as the U.S., which spearheaded the so-called war on terror, claimed it had fought terrorists and made the world safer as a result, many are of the belief that the opposite now holds true. Just one of the angles that we will be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest. Richard Becker joins us from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Also joining us, Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist who joins us from Normandy. Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Richard Becker, looking at the country that the U.S. attacked on this anniversary and occupied subsequently, which is Afghanistan. For more than 20 years, it was there. It fought the Taliban, and now the Taliban is ruling the country. Never mind the shambolic departure from Afghanistan. Why did the U.S. fail so miserably when it came to the country that it went after the 9/11 attacks?
Well, in almost every case, the U.S. occupation, particularly of large or medium-sized countries, fails in the end because the people do not wish to be, with all the other complexities that are included or need to be included in talking about Afghanistan or talking about Iraq or talking about Vietnam or any of the countries where the U.S. has gone to war, the overriding factor for why the U.S. loses the wars is that the people in those countries do not wish to live under foreign occupation and don't accept it. And very different types of resistance organizations arise in the different countries. But I still would say that the underlying factor, and they may give leadership and do give leadership in very different ways, but the underlying uncontestable factor is that there are people nowhere in the world who want to live under foreign occupation.
When you talk about living under foreign occupation, Jeff Brown, our guest there, making that statement, it brings about the notion of how the U.S. wanted to do nation building, which is still, I think, is in pursuit of doing when you look at the interventions in so many other countries. Why does the U.S. feel like it needs to actually do that and spread its so-called democracy onto other nations?
Well, it's not just the United States. It's the West in general. The people of the West. This goes back to the Greeks and the Romans, the Roman Catholic Church, the Crusades, and then combining all of that evangelicism and I'm right, you're wrong, do it our way or die, has gone back for thousands of years. And then, of course, when you combined it with imperialism and capitalism during the colonial period, starting in the 15th century, it's based on racism. It's based on the fact that everybody out there who is not Western is inferior or subhuman, and the West has the divine right to intervene anywhere and expect everybody to adopt its model, and if they don't, to force them through extermination, expropriation, genocide, etc.
Richard Becker, this question has been stated time and again, but it deserves not only to be brought up, but also for an answer to be released somehow, and that is about how the U.S. Justice Department not releasing these documents on Saudi Arabia's role in the 9/11 attacks. We know that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. That much we do know. Why is this not being released? And it's ironic, isn't it, that the U.S. has supported Saudi Arabia, which is responsible for supporting terrorist groups and for many of these groups to follow that Wahhabi ideology, which originates from Saudi Arabia.
Well, you know, the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia is a terrible relationship. I mean, the Saudi Arabia was brought into being as a country only in 1932 when the U.S. and the British supported the Al Saud family in conquering the peninsula and often really committing genocidal extermination of its rivals, of others who lived in the peninsula. And, you know, in the late 1930s, the headquarters of Aramco, the U.S. oil company, U.S. controlled oil company there, was in the same building as the U.S. embassy in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, when we look to come forward to the 1980s, the U.S. Really, its biggest operation, CIA's biggest operation up until that time, was the war in Afghanistan. And the war in Afghanistan, the CIA intervention began before the Soviet intervention began, contrary to the myth that is perpetrated to us today and has been for many decades now. But that intervention gave rise to Osama bin Laden, and out of it came Al-Qaeda. And out of Al-Qaeda, we certainly believe, came the 9/11. And then, you know, so we have this history where the U.S. Has such a checkered history, such a terrible history, and such a complex history, that it certainly is understandable why the U.S. establishment, the ruling establishment, does not wish for everything to be made known, and in fact must conceal a great deal from the population. And this is not only in regard to the relationship with Saudi Arabia, but since this is the 9/11 anniversary and we're talking about it, it certainly applies to the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
Okay. Well, taking a look at different angles of the 9/11 attacks, Jeff Brown, and one of them is how the American weapons manufacturers made out on this. And we're looking at figures that vary, but one of them that's astounding and stands out is about $7.35 trillion over the course of the past 20 years, according to a report that that we had. Lindsay Kashagarian, program director of the National Priorities Project, actually revealed this particular figure to be higher than the $7 trillion. That's $21 trillion since 9/11, because she believes that there are other expenses that are not being reported. Anyways, are we looking at the fact that this trend is continuing in one respect? Because after the 20 year or 21 years to have finished, we're now looking at Ukraine turning out to be somewhat of a long war. Is this something that military manufacturers in the U.S. Are after in this flow of money that comes with the war?
Please let me back up first, and I've got really good news for the world's 1 billion something Muslim people and the Nation of Islam. There were no Saudi Arabian hijackers. I have done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of research on this subject, and included an entire chapter about 9/11 in my second book, and it was a false flag. This was a gigantic deep state CIA, Israeli Mossad operation. You don't bring down four buildings in New York with two airplanes. There was no airplane that crashed in Pennsylvania. There was no airplane that crashed into the Pentagon. This was a huge manipulation, a huge a mirage, so that the, as you said, the military-industrial complex and the nation and the United States' neoliberal neocon hawks wanted to full-spectrum dominance, to control the Muslim population around the world, specifically starting with Iraq, Iran, Libya, all the countries that were not in the back pocket of the United States. The Muslim world has, you know, massive resources, hydrocarbons, minerals, agriculture, and Afghanistan was simply it was just a decoy. And Osama bin Laden was just a decoy, and this is all thanks to the U.S. with Mossad perpetrating this horrific false flag in order to declare war on the Islamic nation around the world.
Okay.
So yeah, it's for money. It's billions and billions and billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, and it's a chance to invade, occupy, and exterminate America's perceived enemies.
Well, first of all, do you agree with that, Richard Becker? And when we talk about the revenues that are generated by the military, whether it's the military weapons manufacturer or it's the military contractors, which have made out quite big on this, I think the figure on the military contractor side of things was $10 trillion on the military, $7 trillion of that went to the military contractors based on this one report. These are astronomical figures. First of all, do you think that this money was well spent when it comes to the so-called war on terror?
Well, let me say, first of all, I believe that those were real planes that crashed into real buildings. And I don't agree with your other guests that this was a false flag operation. I think that that's based on the assumption that anything that happens anywhere in the world, appears to go against the United States is the result of some manipulation, and it's the Mossad. And no, that's not true. They do their own conspiracies, but they become known, and they become known very quickly. You know, in 1956, there was a very real conspiracy of Britain, France, and Israel against Egypt. That was known. The people involved in it, a week later, it was on the front page of Time magazine. You know, no one has come forward and said, yeah, I was part of the conspiracy in this. And now we're 21 years later, and the idea that this would not have come to the real evidence wouldn't have come out by now. No, it's what happened. But then the U.S. leaders, the Bush administration, Cheney, and the rest of them used this to do what they wanted to do and had wanted to do for a number of years and were planning to do, which was not make war on Afghanistan. That was not the main war. The main war was to be the war on Iraq, which from their point of view would be used then in their neocon ideology. That would change the world and assure that the U.S. was the hegemonic power for the rest of, you know, the century and far into the future in their warped outlook. Has this been profitable to the military-industrial corporations? Unbelievably profitable. The figures that you mentioned earlier of trillions of dollars in profit for what is the most profitable part of the economy, together with the oil companies and the big banks, who together comprise the core of power in the United States. It's been an unbelievable reward for them beyond their wildest dreams, I think, and it continues today.
Well, we're looking at one of the core, obviously, focuses of this so-called war on terror, Jeff Brown, to be to eradicate terrorism and to exterminate terrorists. Simply put. But as we have seen the years go by, and in particular, when we take a look back in the last decade on the war on Syria, for example, there have been plenty of evidence out there of either U.S. direct or covert support for terrorists, which has happened in the form of different branches of what we group together and call Daesh terrorists, whether it's, again, from the U.S. directly or through its allies. So this has morphed into the U.S. trying to fight terrorists into them supporting terrorists. How did things come about that way and for it to turn out that way when the focus should be just to get rid of terrorists altogether?
When the United States under Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski went into Afghanistan, and Mr. Becker alluded that it was actually before that, which doesn't surprise me. Once the Soviets left, the neocons in Washington knew they had a good thing on their hands with Al Qaeda, and they kept Al Qaeda as a proxy army to use across the globe, especially in the Muslim world. To create terror, attack their enemies, et cetera. All these terrorist groups are U.S.-backed, CIA-backed, George Soros, NGO-backed. They have never, the United States has never fought terrorists. They create terrorists. They move them around in Department of, in Air Force airplanes, Navy airplanes. They move them in ships. They move them wherever they can to create chaos and terror and genocide in countries all over the world, including China, which is why the Chinese had to take Xinjiang in their own, the government of China had to take Xinjiang under special care because they were shipping Uyghur terrorists back to China. Mm-hmm. So it's the United States that is the world's biggest terrorist organization, and not these. They get funded with guns and arms and vehicles and money, et cetera. Libya is now a gigantic terrorist center to spread chaos in Nigeria, Mali, elsewhere. So this is all Syria. This is all being perpetrated by the United States and its allies, of course, its vassal allies in Europe.
Well, Richard Becker, what do you think at this point? Based on we're going along with that train of thought, it's very interesting that last year the SCO actually, amongst other countries, I must say, including Russia, raised the alarm on the fact that these Daesh terrorists, as we call them, are being transferred from Syria and Iraq to Afghanistan. And it is said that the U.S. is involved in this. So it's just quite ironic that the place that the U.S. attacked to get rid of terrorists, they're now being accused of transferring them and moving them into Afghanistan in order to create instability there, which has a long story as to why that U.S. has that intention. Again, do you see the U.S. so deeply involved as to backing terrorists as a whole?
I think that what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan that is really, really terrible is that having withdrawn, the U.S. has seized the very limited assets. I mean, we're talking between the U.S. and its European allies, something like $9 billion, but hunger, starvation, malnutrition is now widespread in the country. I think that's the big crime that is being committed against the government, the Taliban, the new Taliban government in Afghanistan, and but most importantly, against the people of Afghanistan. So you have this, when the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989, the process was carried out. The U.S. immediately stopped. They withdrew, and Afghanistan descended into civil war, a terrible civil war that led to the rise of the Taliban as an organization to provide some modicum of security and stability for people. But the U.S. went in from the famous Brzezinski interview back in 1997, 18 years after the fact, where he said that in 1979 he advised Carter that we could give the Soviet Union their Vietnam. How's that for a great aspiration, a great democratic aspiration, considering millions who died in Vietnam? We could give the Soviet Union their Vietnam by intervening now and force the Soviet Union to intervene when the government appeared to be about to be overthrown. And then as soon as the Soviet Union withdrew, the U.S. withdrew as well. So there's been no consideration at all for the interest of the Afghan people in the U.S. policy in Afghanistan.
What is very interesting about this so-called war on terror, Jeff Brown, is the fact that we're looking, and I'm looking at this lens, and tell me if I'm right or wrong and what your thoughts are. You're looking at this to have expanded to, we have as a source, 85 countries. In terms of how the U.S. has expanded itself militarily. And it's training actually in some of these countries, if not many of them, it's training their militaries where the U.S. is actually not only having lucrative military deals with them, it's training the actual army. Now, what's interesting is the fact that obviously the U.S. has to get something back in return, aside from military sales, and it looks like perhaps the governments of those countries need to somehow fall in line with the U.S. foreign policy, whatever those objectives might be. Tell us if you think that that is the case. And one headline that I just looked up before I asked you this question, it says, in Africa, U.S.-trained militaries are ousting civilian governments in coups. Go ahead.
Well, that hasn't changed for many, many decades. As far as coups and color revolutions, as they became more commonly known after Tiananmen Square in 1989, which was a CIA operation. But I do want to emphasize that this is not a war on terror. This is a war on Islam. This is a war on all of the Islamic countries, all of the Muslim countries, as well as other countries in Africa. This has nothing to do with terrorism. The United States is using terrorism to attack countries that are not obedient prostitutes for their human and natural resources, like Iran, which is independent of U.S. imperialism and colonialism. Going in and doing color revolutions has been going on for so long. That's nothing new. And of course, it's not just controlling the people. It's not just controlling the government. It's the resources that are there. It's the human resources. It's the natural resources. Being able to occupy a country like South Sudan or some country in Africa is strategically important for the United States to be able to maintain its 900 and something military installations around the world. This is empire. This is Western empire, and the United States happens to be the last one after the English.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're fresh out of time, but thank you so much for that. Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist from Normandy. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Thank you. Spoke to us from San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.